No matter what you do as a woman with a career, it's wrong. You're too warm, too nice, so people perceive you as a mom figure and don't respect you. You're not warm enough, so you're a bitch and need to work on your social skills. You're too ambitious and you need to be cut down. You're not ambitious enough, so the wage gap is your fault. You're too pretty somehow, and then also not pretty enough, and no matter what happens, there's some reason you caused it, as if women in the workplace are happily choosing our own oppression. It reached a point for me where the continuous barriers and stress were too much. Meanwhile, my husband was able to effortlessly ascend the career ladder in spite of being an incompetent asshole who sexually harassed his colleagues. So ultimately, I decided to become a stay-at-home mother so he could focus on his career. And now I am trapped. The trap was laid 20 years ago in my first job when the misogyny started. Motherhood accelerated it, and now I see no way out of this marriage and into the life I thought I could have. Hi, I'm Zahn Vilines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Today, I am talking to Stephanie O'Connell about her incredible new book, The Ambition Penalty. Stephanie is an award-winning writer covering ambition, money, and power with bylines in Slate, Bloomberg, CNBC, Glamour UK, Newsweek, USA Today, and Business Insider. She also wrote, hosted, and co-produced the Webby Award-winning podcast Money Confidential for Real Simple Magazine. Her book, The Ambition Penalty: How Corporate Culture Tells Women to Step Up and Then Pushes Them Down, is an essential guide to dismantling the hidden forces that hold women back, burn them out, and make us all pay. With over 100,000 followers across her social media channels and two ambitious newsletter, Stephanie uses data to expose how power and gender collide to keep women in their place. And she shows how liberating women's ambitions can liberate us all. Before we get started, a few quick administrative reminders. First, you can find all of the books I mentioned on the show, as well as a ton of reading lists and recommendations on the Liberating Motherhood Bookshop page at bookshop.org/shop/liberatingmotherhood. The Liberating Motherhood website has a cornucopia of information about my work and this podcast, including details on how to appear on the podcast, how to submit a story for the podcast, how to submit an advice question, how to contact me, and a bunch of other stuff. Check it out at liberatingmotherhood.org. And finally, just a reminder that this podcast is free, but it is not free to make. My work exists solely because of the commitment and generosity of paid subscribers. People who pay to support this work get a bonus podcast every month, at least 8 extra essays each month, and access to the private Liberating Motherhood support group. Subscribe at zahn.substack.com. If you'd like to help support the podcast in other ways, then liking, commenting, sharing, or leaving a positive review is more helpful than you might realize. This feeds the all-powerful algorithm and tells them that feminist content is valuable so that we can all see and enjoy more of it. Stephanie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm so excited to have you and so excited about your new book.
Well, I am a big fan of yours, Zahn, and also all of the clarity that you bring to the way we talk about stats or problems that a lot of us recognize in the discourse around relationships and gender and inequality, but that people kind of just brush off as somehow making sense. And you just rightfully call out that no, it actually doesn't make sense. This mass exploitation, oppression, and exhaustion of women is not logical in any way. And it's not something that we should be so culturally comfortable accepting. So thank you for having me. And thank you for letting me talk about how this plays out, across the public sphere as well as the personal sphere.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I see a theme in both of our work where there's this idea that women are choosing their own oppression. And our opening vignette sort of nods at that, where it's like a personal empowerment problem. And if you just took the right self-help class and did enough seminars and made enough lists, then you could get your way out of your own oppression and maybe oppress some other women in the process. And I see this all the time with work advice of like women don't ask for raises as if women don't know that they're working for money. Or like women aren't assertive enough as if like women aren't able to like assess when it's safe to be assertive and when it's not. So I guess tell me about how you came to write this book and tell me what the ambition penalty is and what you mean by that term.
I started researching this book because I had been writing about personal finance for a decade, and I was steeped in these stories about claims that women don't earn as much money because they don't quote unquote choose high paying jobs, or they choose quote unquote again to scale back their careers so that they can have children, or that they don't ask for more money, or that they're not willing to speak up and ask for more. And this is a common narrative that we still hear today. And the more I reported on the stories of women who were actually having these experiences in the workplaces, not only did I see how much these claims were simply not borne out in the stories of the women I was speaking to, they also weren't borne out in the data. The data was very clear that women have been negotiating salaries for decades now, even more so than their male peers in the United States. And so the reason they weren't making as much money when they asked for more was not because they didn't ask, but because they were more likely to be penalized for asking, because they were women who dared to assert themselves and speak up and claim their power in a world in which we only say that those things are acceptable, much less rewarded, in men. And so, what I started to look into were all of these double standards between how you get ahead and what happens when you have the exact same input, but the output you get in the workplace really depends not on how you ask or when you ask or what you do as an individual, but rather your identity as the person doing the asking. And when you have a system that creates different outputs for the same inputs, depending on the identity of the individual, that's not an individual problem, that's a system problem. And so the book really was born out of deconstructing that obscures this reality and gets us to think that the problem is ourselves and that we can somehow choose our way out of inequality or self-help or self-optimize a way out of our own oppression. Because what that essentially does is keep us trapped in a loop of self-optimization, trying to be more firm or more aggressive or more deferential or more compassionate or more self-sacrificing or more self-serving. And what you ultimately wind up in is a catch-22 in which there's just no right way to be a woman and to claim the things that you want when what you want is equitable access to pay or power or leadership or even simple things like leisure and personal safety and autonomy, because that is the system that is being protected by self-helpification of all of this kind of individualized and internalized advice.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting how I'll watch with friends how whatever their personality is and like whatever their approach to work is will be used as a reason that they don't command authority and that they don't deserve more money. The racial justice educator Desiree Stevens is one of my dear friends, and I had her on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and somehow we got on the side tangent about Substack because she has a Substack and I have a Substack, and we were both talking about how people feel about paying for Substacks. And she made this really interesting point that has been sticking with me ever since. And so, you know, Desiree is a Black single mother, and I am a white married mother. And so, what Desiree told me is people see her and they perceive her as poor. And so, they perceive her as deserving of and in need of money. So they're initially more willing to pay for her Substack. But because they perceive her as in need of money, they will also use that money to punish her. You know, they'll unsubscribe when they get mad. And also because they perceive her as in need of money, they see her as less authoritative. So they see their contribution to her as charity. And then she said, with me, they see me as authoritative, but not as in need of money. And so they're much more reluctant to pay for my work, even though they view it as authoritative. And if either of us had a change in our circumstances, whatever that change was would then be used as a reason either not to pay or not to value us. You know, if she got married, then it's like, well, she's got a man now, so we don't need to pay her. And I've, you know, and the common denominator there is just the devaluation of women's work, no matter who they are, what they're producing, or what their circumstances are.
That's exactly right. There was a really great paper that was recently published in 2023 by Amy Deal, Leanne Zabinski, and Amber Stevens. And they were studying women leaders across different industries. And what they found was that women's identities were always used as a justification for their exclusion, but it wasn't their gender specifically that was weaponized against them. Instead, gender bias manifested by weaponizing their other identity characteristics through double standards that were not applied to their male peers. So, for example, when you talk about age, the researchers found that young women were considered too young to lead, but older women were seen as too old. And so then there's no right age for a woman to be a leader. Meanwhile, of course, men have their age framed as an asset. So if you're an older man, you're a mature leader. If you're a young man, it's fresh new thinking. And they found that there were 30 of these different identity characteristics that range from, age to race to marital status to introversion to extroversion, basically every single kind of quality that intersects with your gender identity wound up being weaponized against women in this way. So one of the things that this book is really about exposing, and I think your example is a really good job of exposing, is that gender bias is not necessarily as explicit as people saying, like, we're not going to let you pay you because you're a woman. But that doesn't mean it's any less common. Or am I saying that right? It's still just as common, being my point. And what I'm trying to show here is how it is better hidden. And so, we're seeing in your example, you have, the racial identity can be weaponized against you in either way, but either way, you're going to be held to a standard that is not being applied to your male peers. And again, we see this across every single metric. And I want people to understand that just because people aren't coming out and saying, we're not going to support you or pay you or allow you to advance because you're a woman doesn't mean that they are not still acting on the biases that produce these same unequal outcomes. It's still very, very much with us. And I think one of the things that I really go through a lot of lengths to point out in the book is the extent to which so many metrics of inequity, gender identity being just one of those inequities, really have been stuck in place for decades now. And not just in the United States, but increasingly globally, there is this mythology that, if we were empowered enough, that with enough ambition and assertiveness and education, we hear all the time about how women are outpacing their male peers in college education. And I point out that, that's been true for 40 years. That has not changed the reality of the fact that women, especially women of color, especially women at the intersection of multiple marginalized identities, need to have more education and experience and credentials just to earn as much as their male peers. And it hasn't changed the fact that pay gaps, unpaid labor gaps, all of these chronic inequities, basic access to safety, it's still a huge and glaring inequality that's been locked in place again for decades, in spite of our education, in spite of our ambition, in spite of us doing all of the quote unquote right things. And so a lot of this is kind of trying to understand, even if it's less explicit, how is it still showing up in ways that people can stop blaming themselves and stop buying into the gaslighting that it's a them issue?
Yeah. So while you're talking about this, I was thinking about how when I first started my career, I was mindful that as a writer, I had to market myself, and I really had to market like myself as a person and have the right sort of demeanor and be perceived in a certain way. And I had this feeling that I was perceived as like not credible and kind of stupid. Because that was the way I got treated out in public. I would go to events with my husband, and people would assume that I was a trophy wife. And then when they learned that I worked, they would assume that I was just doing it for like pin money. And like, I just couldn't get anyone to take me seriously. And I really like pinned this on myself. So I started like reading self-help books and also trying to get role models of like powerful women leaders. And over time, what I sort of realized is that any role model I could find was someone who had been incredibly demeaned, never for being a woman, but it was always a woman. And that there was no model for like women to command power. You were, too pretty or not pretty enough. You're too warm or not warm enough. And then you change it and then you're the other thing. So I really appreciate how you're speaking to that. I really appreciate you addressing the women not negotiating thing because that just makes me crazy. Talk to me about some other myths we see about women, work, the wage gap, power, all of it. Like what are some popular beliefs that you're seeing that are just completely wrong?
Women aren't confident. Women aren't interested in male-dominated fields. Women aren't interested in leadership positions. Women who are interested in leadership positions aren't choosing the right ones. When they do choose it, they simply lose interest over time. Women have less ambition over time because they just naturally have different priorities than their male peers. Actually, this whole idea that women and men are fundamentally and completely biologically different, like in ways that are Mars and Venus, that the whole thing, I dedicate a chapter to it in the book. It is really essential to upholding a lot of these other myths because you really, to be able to buy into inequality, you have to believe that men and women are really fundamentally and unchangeably different. And not only that, you also have to buy into a kind of hierarchy that positions men and women as one as being superior to the other, even in kind of a complementarian view of things that says, okay, it's not that men and women are better or worse, it's just that they're different. And it's one of those things that, like, you can kind of get on board with until you actually parse out how that language is being used and weaponized against people. And of course, I think the separate but equal doctrine of the Jim Crow era is a really good example of what is wrong with the way we kind of weaponize rhetoric in this way. Because every single time, it's not that when we do point out differences between men and women, we're using that to claim that, oh, therefore women should have more support and have more access to leadership and power because they are the ones who are, by and large, raising the next generation and being tasked with this incredible and important work of community care. Instead, it's used as a reason to devalue everything women do and to say that's why they shouldn't have access to equitable resources and supports. And so I'm always bringing all of these different myths back from the simple myth of women don't ask for more to women are from Venus, men are from Mars, that it all comes back to this fundamental idea that not only are men and women very categorically different in ways that manifest themselves in completely polar opposite interests, but that men's interests are therefore deserving of greater support and rewards. And so a whole chapter of the book is really dedicated to dismantling that foundational myth that supports all of the others.
Yeah, I appreciate that you mentioned that because I'm actually interviewing Cordelia Fine later today,
Yes.
who talks about how harmful this gender difference nonsense is. So I might have to point out your book to her.
Yeah, I think she might, she's probably cited in my book
Yeah, no,
because, yeah.
she's amazing. I just adore her. And so yeah. But I do want to talk about this gender difference stuff because the thing that I find is that people who argue with me online and people who just argue with me generally base their arguments on a world that literally does not exist, where women do not work for pay, never work for pay, and have never worked for pay. When in reality, most women work for pay,
Yes.
including more than 70% of mothers. And
Yes.
the reality that these women face is that while they have similar or even more intense work obligations than their male partners, their partners then continue to foist most of the work at home onto the women. So working men get the advantage of having a spouse at home doing it all, even if she's also working. And then working women are saddled with an endless list of invisible labor that can undermine their ability to do everything else. Talk to me about the effects of this. And also, I guess I kind of want to acknowledge that like women are still excelling at work in spite of this.
Correct. One of the things I like to point out is just what you said, that first of all, every woman works in some capacity, whether she's paid or not. And then almost all women are engaging in paid work on top of their unpaid labor, just in terms of like a majority of the population, certainly a majority of mothers. I like to point out that 45% of women are the financial breadwinners in their household. And yet, you know, we never compare men's incomes to the cost of childcare. There is this bizarre devaluation of not just women's labor, but even their incomes, like even the meaningful financial contributions that they do bring into their household. And to your point, this creation of a myth that not only do women not work, but that the work that they do, that the income they do provide is somehow pin money, right? It's frivolous, it's for fun. And this even comes up in the research in terms of how household income is distributed and who gets to make the final decisions about things like where the money goes in the household. And it's overwhelmingly still in heterosexual relationships, men, even when women earn more, just like it's still women who are left with all of the extra unpaid labor in relationships, even when women earn more. And so I think this is a really important thing to acknowledge is that, you know, women can have greater financial power in a couple or in even in certain areas of like let's say an industry or a workplace. And yet that does not exempt them from these broader dynamics of a world in which we still do not believe women are entitled to equal say or authority or even pleasure and enjoyment. When people talk about, you know, they're comparing household labor or they're comparing incomes, I always like to look at leisure. You know, we often talk about work, we talk about pay, and I think that can really conflate work hours that are paid versus unpaid. And so people are like, oh, well, men are working more hours. And it's like, well, if you're talking about work, we have to talk about all work. And what we see over and over again is that women have less access to downtime, free time, leisure, hobbies, basic time to do anything for themselves or with others even, but in their own leisure time, in a way that is true no matter how much they earn. And it is true consistently in relationships and out of relationships, because even if they're not partnered, you know, women as daughters are still less likely to be supported. They're for those who receive allowances, for example, they receive fewer, less money, and they are tasked with more tasks. So when it comes to household chores, that kind of unequal division of labor is already established long before women become partnered. And certainly when it comes to taking care of family members, parents, it's daughters who are still overwhelmingly tasked with all of the extra elder care. And this is important work. This is not to say women shouldn't be doing this work, but it's to say that men should be doing it too, and that that work should be valued. And so any argument that says that, you know, women are less deserving or are, you know, are being paid less because it makes sense in some way, or that they should have less access to leisure, is just really predicated on a on this larger idea that women's time doesn't matter, or, you know, to come to your work, you know, should be channeled into preserving the time and the power and the pay of their male peers, whether those be partners or whether they be brothers or fathers or men in society in general, whether they be billionaires who, you know, rely on the whole unpaid care economy for the rest of the economy to function.
So I have this idea of patriarchy as like a system of invisible rules. And once you start to identify the rules, you're like, oh yeah, I am operating according to those rules. And one of them is the rule that everything women do is leisure. And I feel like we see this all the time that, you know, household labor, that's leisure. Elder care, that's leisure. Parenting, that's leisure. But we also see it in the attitude toward working for pay. I see constantly the idea that women who go out and have careers are doing it for fun and because they're spoiled and often doing it as an inferior choice to their rightful role of staying at home. Of course, when they do stay at home, we say that they're not working and it has no value. And I just think that we see this constantly, and I think that it really affects women at work because no matter how hard a woman works, no matter what she does, it's devalued. It's just some like silly little woman thing she's doing.
Exactly, right? It's still this ridiculous argument that, well, men need to be paid more because they are the providers in a family, right? What does that mean? Providing what? You know, if your life doesn't fundamentally change after you have a kid, I don't really know that you're providing anything. So it's the women who are out here who are still continuing to maintain jobs, careers for pay, who are and taking on the household labor that comes with being partnered or becoming a parent, and who are doing this added caregiving, if not all themselves, then coordinating it all through the mental load and the emotional labor. And so I just call it's just so absurd once you think of things through this framework of, you know, data, which is what I do. I focus a lot on what do the numbers say. And the numbers are very, very clear that, to your point, you know, majority of mothers are working. You know, 40 again, 45% of households rely on a woman who is the financial breadwinner. And yet the world continues to justify inequality by saying, well, men are the providers and therefore they deserve to be, you know, advanced more and have more opportunity. And so once you can see that for the lie that it is, the rest of all of the arguments and the myths really start to unravel pretty quickly. And that's what I'm really hoping to do in the book is really just say, hey, you know, as soon as you stop buying into the myth making, you can really start to challenge the status quo, because the status quo kind of falls apart when we stop saying, actually, this makes sense. It doesn't make sense for women who are the ones who are overwhelmingly both financially and physically and emotionally taking care of their families, their communities, and one another to also be paid the least and to be invested with the least amount of power and privilege and support in society. It makes no sense. The idea that people are out here saying, you know, well, you know, motherhood happens, and therefore, you know, you see this women's earnings plateauing 10 years before their male colleagues. I mean, it's just absurd. To buy into that, you have to actually believe that, you know, women's time doesn't matter, or to your point, that the time that they do use for work or for care is all leisure, that it's frivolous, and so it doesn't need to be meaningfully supported or compensated. And certainly they don't need to be invested with any kind of real public power or decision making. And I just think like it's so indicative of how misogynistic our world still is that we accept that as common wisdom, as opposed to saying, you know, actually, it's the people who are doing all of this labor, who are doing the essential care, who really should be in charge of more of our power and resources, and should be the ones making decisions that are going to affect the next generation and the people who are at most risk today. And so, one of the things that I write about in the book is a framework I call like single mother best, which is based off of a framework that an economist named Janelle Jones coined, Black Woman Best, which is basically if you build an economy that works for those who are most marginalized within it, then you will uplift everyone else in as a result. So if you are supporting, you know, single mothers who, and especially single mothers at the intersection of multiple marginalized identities, and you are making it possible for them to access the support they need, the opportunities they need, the rewards they need, everyone else who is dealing with less burden and less barriers and fewer biases by comparisons will also be better served. So it's a complete flipping of the framework from saying, you know, we want only this very specific old white Ivy League educated dude to have a position of power to say, how can we give the most supports and voice to those who are most marginalized within our systems and center their needs and their perspectives to better inform policy that works for everyone as a result? Because that's how we get to collective well-being. And a lot of the focus of the book is really about stopping this idea of trying to optimize for relative outcomes, particularly in patriarchy. We're talking about relative well-being of men over women, but certainly this is true across other metrics of identity. But the way in which we're incentivized to maintain our relative outcomes winds up undermining our absolute well-being. So because men want to make sure they're going to be better off than you as a woman, what actually happens is they wind up doubling down on the policies that make it worse for all of us, including themselves, to get by. And so that's how you get to places where, like, people aren't in unions and they aren't working collectively. They are willing to buy into hustle culture and work longer and longer hours, even as they're not actually being productive, and even as they're not seeing a return on all of that extra labor, because they're incentivized to make sure that they're still going to be better off than you, even if they're worse off overall.
That's such so I really appreciate you highlighting this. And I, when I kind of hit this part in your book, it gave voice to something that I feel like I've been talking around but have not articulated that well. And I think that you did a beautiful job doing it. So I'm going to just kind of highlight it, which is, patriarchy benefits men because they steal resources from women and then they have those resources and they're doing better than women. But it also harms men, and both can kind of be true. And I think that this notion of relative well-being is really helpful for understanding it, because men are stealing things from women and dragging us all down when they do it. They might be able to earn a little more or get a little more free time, but they're living these like meaningless, shitty lives and destroying society in the process. And I just like I appreciate how you name that.
Yeah, and I'll call out a couple of data points just to make my case, because
Yeah,
that's
please
part of what
do.
I do. So there's an analysis, 2 decades of data across 140 nations, that finds gender equality is associated with lower income inequality and lower wealth inequality for everyone. Another analysis of over a decade of 156 countries finds that greater gender equality is associated with longer life expectancy for both men and women. Gender equality is also positively correlated with GDP per capita. So when gender inequality is low, people tend to enjoy both higher incomes and higher standards of living. That's according to the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap Index. We also see these improvements across metrics of work-life balance and well-being. By contrast, greater gender inequality is associated with greater income and wealth inequality, lower standards of living, lower work-life balance and well-being, and shorter lifespans. And then also we see more collective violence, more anti-democratic tendencies. I think that will probably resonate with people who are listening to this right now in the year 2026. A lot of this kind of hierarchical, these hierarchies across gender and race and class, so much of anti-democratic government and authoritarian government is really dependent on people buying into preserving their relative privilege within those hierarchies, as opposed to coming together to fight back against what is happening, at against those in positions of power, among those in positions of power, rather. And so, one of the things I really want to point out in this book is this idea of collective action and how important it is to get out of not just the group mindset, stay at home mom versus work at home mom, even men versus women, me versus you, but rather to understand our outcomes are really being shaped not by these individual things, but by these broader things. Collective forces, collective biases, collective forms of discrimination that are not happening to us because of some kind of like man versus woman thing or me versus you thing, but because we're in a broader system that says a man is supposed to be, ambitious, strong, brave, and a woman is supposed to be caring, compassionate, and those two things are mutually exclusive. And if you dare to step into a lane that is not yours, quote unquote, then you will face punishment because that's not serving anybody. It's not serving men either, as you point out.
Yeah, I mean, it's solidarity is what you're talking about. And
Exactly.
like I see it all the time, in leftist circles, we talk all the time about how, pitting women against other women is always going to be a tool of patriarchy. Pitting black women against white women keeps us all down. And pitting men and women against each other prevents us from noticing the ways that the powerful people we never see are oppressing us all.
Yes. That being said, one of the way things I do want to call out is that when I talk about men and women or like me versus you, what I'm talking about is social groups. I think a lot of the times there's a conflation of like, well, I chose this and you're criticizing me. And so, therefore, you're the one who's not building solidarity. You're criticizing men. And I'm like, no, I'm criticizing a system that says the only way to be a man is to be this way. And the only way to be a woman is to be this way. And the only people deserving our reward of rewards are supposed to be compliant with those categories. And I don't think that when people are acting in ways that reinforce that status quo, that they are immune from criticism. I think it's important that we be able to talk about these things on a systemic level, even when we're talking about it in the framework of an individual choice. And that's not to say like I think we need to be focused on individual choices. I don't think that, but I think there has been this obsession with saying, no individual choice is above reproach, even if that individual choice is like Amy Coney Barrett, like voting away your reproductive rights. That's not feminism. It might be her choice to do that, but it's not feminism.
Thank you so much for making that point. I see, this is why I love talking to you, Stephanie, because you're just like having a conversation with you is like you can feel like patriarchy building like the wedge in your argument. And then all of a sudden you come along and close it and you're like, nope, not that one. And then it like goes the other way and you're like, nope, not that one either. And that is how the book reads. And I love that about your book and about you and your work. So thank you for being the way you are.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad it reads that way because I really had to kind of unpack a lot of this for myself too. I did sit with this for a long time and think, am I the problem I'm speaking about, right? I'm saying we need to have solidarity. I'm saying we need to have collective action. And yet I have a whole chapter of this book that really goes deep on these trends we've been seeing recently, like trad wives and soft life and feminine energy, and a lot of these social media hashtags that are glorifying, a very particular patriarchal prescription of femininity that is really contingent on submission and particularly giving up power as a woman. And I had to really sit with that and say, what is it here that I'm responding to? And to step back and reframe, not me, Stephanie, saying, I'm uncomfortable with what I'm seeing here, but rather to say, no, like this is part of a systemic analysis when we have an entire media ecosystem that is dedicated to amplifying a fantasy that women's lives would be easier if they just gave up their paychecks. That is not an individual problem. That is not about any individual woman's choice or expression. That is an exemplification of the way in which the same old patriarchal messaging is being repackaged and sold to us in ways that we have been told is empowering, even as it actively does the opposite. And that is a systemic issue. Again, it's not about, any individual woman's, posts about it. It's about this broader ecosystem that says, if I wanted to go be a trad wife right now on social media, I could make a lot of money. That's an incentive structure, right? Meanwhile, I'm out here writing this feminist book. Like, how am I going to pay my bills?
My God. Well, this is the thing with the trad wife thing that just makes me lose my ever-loving mind. They're advocating that women should not have jobs through their jobs.
Exactly.
Like that's their job. That's the I can't even with them. It just makes me
Yeah.
crazy.
Not just their jobs. I mean, it's a multi-million dollar business. These women
Yes.
are not just monetizing, they are raking it in. And there is a huge institutional support system behind them. There is the algorithm on social media boosting that content. This is not happening by accident. People are like, why is this so popular? It's like, well, the algorithm is facilitating this because, we're out here, you and I, writing feminist content, and the algorithm doesn't favor it in the same way. And it's not because feminist content is somehow like naturally unpalatable necessarily. It's just that we're not being financed by these multi-million dollar or billion dollar organizations and interests. I like to point out Evie Magazine, for anyone who knows it, they're very into like promoting the tradwife kind of ideal and culture. It's in part found funded, backed by Peter Thiel. The guy who he's like a VC
Oh my God, he's
guy with billions of
so.
dollars. He's a complete pronatalist, total like white supremacist. It's wackadoodle. And it's just like, okay, this magazine is out there and it's growing this huge subscriber base, not because like, oh, this is what women really want, but because there's bazillions of dollars behind it and a whole algorithm behind it.
Yes.
So I do like to point that out. And then of course, I think it's incumbent upon all of us to have a little bit more, not just literacy in terms of understanding how misogyny is showing up in the modern context, but also media literacy to understand that, these things are not happening by accident.
You know, the writer Tia Levings had this post a couple of weeks ago. I can't remember the exact title, but it was something like, "There are no old trad wives." And
Yes.
because you cannot find women in their 60s and 70s who produce content that's appealing, because so much of the trad wife stuff is based on, traditional mainstream sexuality and being pretty blonde, white, and thin. And it's pretty hard to find a woman who says, "Gee, I'm so glad I depended on my husband. That's worked out really well for me."
Exactly. They are all a very, very specific model of a kind of womanhood, an age of womanhood, ideal that it's just it's very clearly propaganda because these women, first of all, they are not living the lifestyles that they preach, right? They
Right.
are running these multi-million dollar businesses. And if they were, the only way you kind of get to spend a whole day, making soda from scratch is if you have money to begin with. I say, it's
Yeah.
a better vision of wealth than of womanhood. If you're not doing the actual necessary of labor to make a life work, when you're not doing the work of like making three meals a day and cleaning up the vomit and the scrubbing the toilets or sitting in an SUV and shuttling kids around to every activity, right? If you have a whole staff who's doing that essential labor behind the scenes, then to your point, like the labor does become leisure. Then you are baking something from scratch because it is fun. And so it's just propaganda on so many, many levels that it's hard to even know where to begin. And yet we're being sold this message that, oh, this is somehow natural, or this is what people are gravitating to out of, oh, exhaustion with a kind of careerism that, in part, there is some truth that the people are exhausted by careerism. But the idea that it's only women who are going to find fulfillment in scaling back or having more rest, even as they're being promoted lifestyles that are actually more labor intensive than
Yes.
and for less money. It's just absurd. And I always like to point out, it would be one thing if these accounts portrayed this lifestyle that isn't real and then said, you know what would actually allow people to obtain this? A universal basic income,
Yeah.
health care, having enough support in your childcare that even if you are baking for 5 hours, you have someone there who can step in to watch your kid if they need. But they're not saying that. They're saying that that lifestyle is enabled by giving up their autonomy and power and resources. And it's actually, I like to point out, kind of falls into the same individualistic trap that a lot of the girl boss and lean in advice really falls into, which is hyper individualizing the problem. So instead of it being about, you're not able to access equitable rewards or support for your labor, it's about, well, the way to get ahead is to be more feminine per these patriarchal and white supremacist prescriptions of being, thin enough or blonde enough or quote unquote feminine enough. And of course, that standard is just steeped in white supremacy. And then on the flip side with the girl boss, it was like, okay, well, the problem is you're not ambitious enough, you're not aggressive enough. And then, of course, when you actually are those things, then that's being weaponized against you. And it's in either case, they're saying that the biggest barrier to getting the life you want, to getting the security, the freedom, the rest is you. And that way, you don't ever have to come back to, well, actually, the biggest barrier to getting the life you want, the freedom and security, is this inequitable system around you, patriarchy, in which, men and women are being given different supports and they're not ac able to access equitable rewards. And that's as much true in the home as it is in the public sphere. And in fact, if you want to change that, the best way to do that is not for women to not be represented in the public sphere so that men can continue to have outsized access to decision making and power, and more of it. It's that more men are in that private sphere sharing the load, and therefore the public sphere, workplaces, power has to accommodate and support men who are doing caregiving, right? If men had to share caretaking responsibilities and household responsibilities, then the workplace would not be able to continue to engage in this doubling down of hustle culture. You would have to accommodate for a school day that ends at 3 p.m. and a work day that ends at 5 p.m. or 6 p.m. because men would be partaking in the home labor as much as women are. And so I really like to caution people against, thinking that these reactionary movements are somehow selling something different, when in fact they're kind of like doubling down on the same individualism and in just a different way. It's a different packaging for getting us to take our eyes off the ball of like this system of power that is about maintaining men's access to power and resources and using women's labor to maintain that. And Tradwife does that as much as a lot of the girl boss does, and in some ways much worse, because it's saying like the only way to get ahead is to contain what you want and not to expand it. And it's a gendered message that is never given to men.
So I have kind of an aside about the Tradwife thing, that, piggybacking on what you said, I want to emphasize that the real solution to more labor and more joy and all of that is equality generally, but especially at home. And I know this because I get a lot, like a lot of questions from readers about time management and how I manage my time. Because, I work full time and I have neurodivergent kids and I have a lot of very intense hobbies that I sort of like advertise and I think people can deduce I'm spending a lot of time on them. And the truth is, I'm not particularly good at time management. I'm not getting this stuff done because I'm uniquely virtuous. I'm getting it done because I'm married to someone who actually shares the load with me. And so, I was thinking about last Friday, I spent 2 hours chasing this tiny fingernail-sized escaped baby gecko around the living room while my husband cooked dinner for the kids. And it's sheer lunacy. But it's like this is the life that we've decided we want, is one where I'm able to chase geckos and where he's able to be a father and we're able to like both have leisure time. And that's existing in a patriarchal society where there are not systemic supports, and goes to show how kind of the choices of an individual man really can matter for the people and the women in his life. I also have a mother-in-law who's very supportive of us, so community matters. And so I raise that to just emphasize to men that we can't end patriarchy today, but you can change your behavior today and at least not recreate patriarchy in your own home. And if we really want to have these slow, beautiful lives that the trad wives pretend to have, it comes through sharing the burden.
I'm really glad that you shared that because I often find that because I talk about things systemically, and I think people who are more progressive minded know to do that, there is often this tendency to say, well, the real problem is that there's just not paid parental leave, or the real problem is that we don't really have a childcare infrastructure. And I am very frustrated by this. I find that there is a lot of this intimate and personal inequality that is brushed off because of the lack of these broader social safety nets. And I think your point here is incredibly important. And one of the things I lay out in the book pretty explicitly is that pushing back against the status quo does not simply happen at the policy level. When I talk about systems, I'm talking about systems of interpersonal power, institutional power, and political and cultural power. And I think one of, to your point, one of the most meaningful ways we can really push back against these systems of power is in the interpersonal level. And so I really encourage people in the book to not think about relationships again in terms of these individual things, but as an institution, marriage, heterosexual partnership as an institution that says it is a woman's role to do this and a man's role to do this. And not to say that, oh, well, you doing all of this extra, carrying all of this extra load as a woman makes sense because there's no paid parental leave. No, that doesn't make sense. In order to get to paid parental leave, you're gonna need more men sharing the load so that the workplace has to change. One of the studies that I was just fascinated by in the book that I talk about is the primary predictor of men taking their parental leave was not what they thought of gender roles, and it wasn't what their partner thought of gender roles. It was what they thought other men believed was an appropriate gender role.
Oh my
And so if
God.
other men took paternity leave, they were more likely to take paternity leave. And to me, like that is the problem, right? Like if what other men do is more important, you value more than what your partner cares about and what's important for them and for you, I can't believe we're going to sit here and justify the inequality that comes out of that. And that's not to say that there might not be consequences if you are in an environment where, fathers are penalized or stigmatized for utilizing the parental leave that they are entitled to. But what we're now saying is that, like, well, because fathers might be judged and face some consequences for utilizing their paid parental leave, we are going to shoulder the costs onto women almost entirely and almost exclusively. So we're saying childcare costs too much in the society. So only women should have to pay that cost. Instead of us being willing to share that load, even if it comes with an economic consequence for us, and saying, like, oh, this is part of not just a broader project in my relationship, but a broader project of challenging a system in which I'm saying, actually, no, I'm going to be a model of the man in the workplace who is taking this leave, and the workplace is actually going to have to accommodate caretaking in a meaningful way, rather than us saying, we're not willing to support this cost, and you can only get away with that by shifting all of that onto women. So I think it's so incredible that, we're not just saying it's about the institutional systems. It has to be operating at the interpersonal systems. And the great thing about that is, to your point, you can change that today. Anyone who really wants to start, men who really want to start taking a more meaningful, active role in their interpersonal life and have household equality, they can start doing that today.
So my husband is going to be very happy with you for saying this. And here's so he has what I would characterize as like a shame-based approach to feminism, where so my husband is like very much like outwardly a stereotypically like masculine guy. He's tall, he's white, he's very fit, he lifts weights, he's successful, he's a lawyer, all of that. And he tries to kind of like weaponize this to like shame other men as like weak. What kind of weak loser are you that like, your kids don't even notice if you're home, sort of stuff. And he really feels strongly that like this is the way to like strong arm other men into doing better. And so I think the idea that, Men care about what other men think more than they care about what women thinks. We all know that, but it certainly supports his idea of, well, that maybe I can just bully them into being feminists.
I mean, like the data does seem to support that, the jockeying for men's approval, status seeking, like that seems to be pretty consistently and certainly in the news cycle, the number one thing that motivates behavior there. And so it's like, I don't know, I'm willing to do what works here.
Yeah, I mean it's so gross, but it's not at all surprising. Okay, so kind of like my final question subject with you is I appreciate how you don't make this another like self-help, but have you considered trying? Have you considered asking for a raise sort of book? But you do lay out some principles for what we can do to counter bias and how we can cope as individuals, because the decisions we make as individuals do advantage or disadvantage us more or less. So I guess my question to you is, I started this interview by talking about how, I looked for ways I could be respected as a woman leader or a woman writer, and I couldn't find them. So we're back to that subject. Like, what can women at work do as individuals?
So I think that in addition to following all of the best practices as much as we know them in the workplace, certainly when it comes to advocating for ourselves, when negotiating salary, I think what we really need to do is add a collective element to anything that we're attempting to do. So let's say if it's asking for more, let's say it's a pay negotiation. So, you've done all of the individual work of looking up market rates for your position, your location, you've practiced your script out loud, you've collected your data points on how the value you provide for the company is in alignment with the salary ne you're negotiating for. You've done every, you've kind of maxed out that individual part of the issue. One of the things I want people to think more about is like, okay, if what is something I can do to advance my cause of being paid equally in tandem with other people? So this is where I talk about some of the policies, in this case, pay transparency, that really work to equalize outcomes across identity. So is it simply cultivating a network of peers who are in your industry or in your company and having open conversations with them around pay, their experiences of what worked for getting ahead, with whom, identifying key decision makers. Maybe it's that simple of cultivating your own kind of own unofficial resource group of people and trusted allies to have these conversations collectively and more transparently. But maybe it's something more formal about, okay, maybe your company has a pay transparency policy in place, but it's not really being enforced in any meaningful way. And is there some kind of collective action you can take so that it's not just you saying, hey, like I know we have this policy, and yet I'm seeing a pay range here that, is tens of thousands of dollars. So it's basically completely useless. And it doesn't even account for bonuses. And we know that a lot of inequity still shows up in these other kind of metrics that are not accounted for here. If you're having that conversation by yourself, that's really tough. Like you got a target on your back. But if you can, again, work in collaboration with other people, then you're engaging collectively in that kind of conversation. So it's not just like you against the company. It's about, the company's interests in enforcing the policies and maintaining the morale of the people who work there as a group. And then, again, thinking more collectively about how do you work with people outside of your own company or network with those who are beyond yourself. I think the biggest thing I want people to cultivate is the practice of not internalizing responsibility for every individual problem, but getting into the practice of collective resistance and building community care. And that is about information sharing as much as it's about, developing just personal relationships so that when you do face backlash, let's say when you ask for more and they come back to you and they say, You should just be grateful that you even have a job here, or that, you're just too difficult to work with, or you're not a right fit. And then they start kind of taking it out on you for daring to suggest you should even be paid more. That you have a community in place so that you're not falling back into that pattern of blaming yourself, and instead you have other people with whom to share this experience and to process that it's not just you. And what you are experiencing is not a personal failing, but it's a failing of a system that rewards men and women differently for engaging in the same behaviors. And so I really, really hope that what people take away is not just this systems thinking and the framework of the interpersonal and the institutional and the political and the cultural, but this bigger shift from cultivating our individual resilience to our collective resilience.
That's such good advice. I love that. And I think, as I always say, there's no like real freedom or liberation without community. And that's true in the workplace too.
Yes, it is. Because, like, you have to accept the fact that you're in a system in which you are being disproportionately burnt out by design, and that's a hard thing to accept. There's this mythology, it's in the same way in relationships, that you can kind of like choose your way out of it, or you can unlock the right combination of words, and magically you'll transcend hundreds of years of misogyny and
Yes.
racism and homophobia and all these other things. And even when you do get ahead, like even if you do get the pay raise and the promotion or whatever, the fact is, like, that is the exception. The rule is still the patriarchal white supremacist systems in which, like, even when you do get the promotion, you're still more likely to be viewed with more credulity. You're still more likely to be undermined when you do get that position of leadership, or be isolated there, or to be tasked with more, or to be rewarded less, until we kind of build this broader community infrastructure in which, women and other marginalized groups are advancing at scale and not just as tokens. And so having the collective resilience and the community and infrastructure, emotionally even, in place to withstand that is so critical if we really want to make meaningful progress on metrics of change.
Yeah. All right. Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for this book and this contribution. Listeners, I really hope you will go out and buy Stephanie's book. It's really excellent. And, we have to vote with our money because when we don't buy feminist books, we give the message that feminist writers are not valuable, and then publishers publish fewer of them. So pre-orders matter. Buying online matters. Please consider getting her book and showing publishers generally and everyone that, yeah, like we should care about half of the population.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you so much for letting me come talk about this. I love your work and I love all of the po interviews you do here. So I hope everyone buys everyone's books, really.
Yeah, just buy them all. Just
Or
and
and
they're
request them from the library too. Like, that's
yeah.
another there's a lot of ways to support too.
Yeah. And if you don't want to buy it or you can't buy it, you can share it. And I will be back next week. And Stephanie, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.